So 3/4 of the food we eat is artificially refrigerated before it gets to us. It's something writer Nicola Twilley calls America's coldscape. She wrote about this huge network of refrigerated spaces in Cabinet magazine. Who knew there was a coldscape or a Cabinet magazine? We want to spend a few minutes today with Nicola, who joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Nicola, you remind us the first patent for a refrigerator was in 1851, but its use in preserving food was initially opposed by the ice industry.
They campaigned heavily against it and portrayed it as unnatural, and that the food that had been kept artificially alive, as it were, under refrigeration was zombie food. And there was actually a classified disease, fear of refrigeration, frigoraphobia, it was called. They really gave it a bad name at the start.
I guess so. So what changed?
Honestly, refrigeration technology improved so that the food tasted a little better and got less sort of burn on it. Economies of scale came down, and after the Second World War, as people moved out of the cities and supermarkets got going, everything just started taking off.
Speaking of which, women took off, in many cases, to work.
That's one of the big drivers.
Yeah, they needed almost like a babysitter for the food at home. Along comes the refrigerator. And reefer fleets, what's that?
A reefer is a refrigerated container. The invention of the container period in 1956 changed everything. That allowed, you know, all of this cargo to be shipped around the world in a standardized shape that could just be lifted off a ship and onto a truck. Figuring out how to refrigerate that then meant that you could bring in lamb from New Zealand, apples from New Zealand, mangoes from the Southern Hemisphere. All sorts of foods could suddenly make their way enormous distances around the world to markets where they would otherwise be out of season.
It's really quite something, because it's so in our recent history. This is not that long ago, 50s, 60s, and it's a reminder of why in some minds the food before that time was kind of bland and not as diverse as it is now.
The reefer itself, for example, wasn't really perfected until the late 70s, early 80s. So we take for granted that we can get all these foods from all around the world.
Well, and you write about a woman that you talked to who devoted 7 years of her life to researching these relatively new refrigerated trucks. She lived in one. They needed to have airflow and respiration and all sorts of things in order to be perfected.
She's actually a senior executive at Maersk, the shipping company now. A lovely woman, Barbara Pratt, who also runs a pick-your-own apple farm. And she started out in her career living in one of those refrigerated containers for years at a time, almost the whole of her 20s, just testing, monitoring the temperature, monitoring the airflow, monitoring how quickly the asparagus was respiring, all of these subtle variations to totally redesign the airflow and the temperature and the insulation inside the reefers so that food would arrive in as good a condition as we want it.
So that's the reefer, the trucks that now have satellites and sensor networks watching them so that they can monitor oxygen, and now they're quite sophisticated. Tell us about some other innovations. The cheese cave. I actually have been in a cheese cave, which is where cheese gets stored in almost this underground mine.
That's right. So traditionally, cheese needs to be aged in a cool, humid space, and caves are a great place to do that naturally. Often those caves have bacteria on the walls that then help mature the flavor of the cheese too. But the cheese cave is still alive, even in the era of industrially produced food, because as it turns out, Kraft has the biggest cheese cave in the world. It just happens to be underground in a former limestone mine. Actually, the mine is still active, so if you go down there, you can hear explosions sometimes in other parts of the mine. But they've rented a chunk of it, and the walls are still sort of unfinished, but they have sprinklers and fluorescent light hanging from them. And in there, Kraft stacks up barrels and barrels and barrels and barrels of cheese whiz and cheese slices and all of the Kraft cheesy goodness that we find in the grocery store shelves. And they keep it there in their industrial cheese cave.
Well, the one I went to is in Missouri. A lot of the government cheese is also stored this way, cheese that goes out through government programs. Just, it's unbelievable. It's like you're in an underground football stadium filled with cheese.
Exactly. It's so weird. And when you think about the fact that, you know, cheese was traditionally made in natural caves, and now we have this enormous, and the cheese is stacked I have four stories high spaces that are still caves, and they're underground, but they're completely unnatural caves for our unnatural version of cheese.
So again, we're tracking these, it's sort of this network of places where foods are stored and kept cold and aged because we live in a time where we're shipping it all over the country. What is a banana ripening room?
Bananas should, by rights, if we didn't have refrigeration, be a very exotic tropical treat. And the reason that we can have them every day and that they're so cheap is because of refrigeration. But it means that we have to harvest them when they're green, and then we ship them under refrigeration, and then we have to artificially ripen them when they get to their destination. That happens in these places called banana ripening rooms. Bizarrely, they are also refrigerated. You would think you would want to warm the bananas up to ripen them, but actually the heat coming off a box of ripening bananas could, you know, heat a small apartment building. So you have to still keep it refrigerated at a certain temperature, and you also have to blast it with this ethylene, which is a sort of a natural ripening gas.
It sounds just awful. You know, what's done to them?
It's an odd setup, certainly. They're kind of being fooled that they're back on the tree again, and then they can be ripened. And it's quite a technical process. They can be, you know, pushed at different speeds. So if, you know, the banana distributor is a little bit short of a particular, of ripe bananas, they can push it really fast by heating it up a couple of degrees, or they can hold it back if they're overstocked by pushing it down another couple of degrees. It's a funny process. And the ethylene itself really smells disgusting. It smells like the carpet of a bar after people have spilled a lot of drinks.
Well, we should say the hormone ethylene occurs naturally in ripening plants, but these picked bananas and also tomatoes are sprayed with the artificial smelly version. Morning Edition featured growers who say the natural tastes better. Nicola Twilley explored the country's food storage for Cabinet Magazine. More here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
We are talking with author and blogger Nicola Twilley, who explored the country's massive network of food storage sites post-refrigeration. She calls it the coldscape. It includes bananas ripening in warehouses rather than on trees, cheese stored in refrigerated mines as opposed to natural caves. Next up, meat. Now, meat needs to hang so enzymes can break down tissue and water can evaporate. Dry aging, it's called. It's why cattle was once slaughtered mainly in winter, so meat could be hung in cold basements. Vacuum packaging then made it possible to wet age meat, let it sit for 2 weeks or so in its own juices. But Nicola Twilley, you found there are still meat lockers. They're just refrigerated now?
Yeah, so meat lockers are another refrigerated space that is actually traditional, like the cheese cave. Until we invented vacuum packaging, all our meat would be hung and aged naturally. Now, of course, it's just the high-end dry-aged meat that you would get in a really fancy steakhouse that is done that way. I visited up in the Bronx one of the meat lockers that handles up to 10% of all the USDA prime meat. Again, it's a refrigerated space, 34 degrees they're kept at, a lot of airflow, so there's standing fans all around. And then there's, at any given day, $1.4 million worth of meat sitting on these wire shelves, aging. Mold is growing on it, but not pathogenic mold. It's very clean, fluorescent lit, white tiled, but it does have a very distinct smell, very malty or even mushroomy almost.
Again, it's striking me. It's so interesting that some of these are such recent developments. There are people who will remember that they went to the butcher for meat. Then this vacuum wrap gets invented only in the 60s, and suddenly you've got all these cuts of meat thrown on the shelves in supermarkets.
That's right. Vacuum packaging is such a recent innovation, really, within people's lifetimes, and it has changed the flavor of meat, is what's so extraordinary. Vacuum packaging saves time, it saves refrigeration costs, it results in less shrinkage of the meat, so more money for the people who are selling it to you by weight. But it does result in what at least one meat scientist described to me as a more serumy flavor than dry-aged meat, which really is kind of a disgusting term. But I think dry-aged meat tastes a lot better. Now it's an acquired taste for people because they're so used to vacuum-packed meat.
So that's meat. Orange juice. Talk about orange juice storage.
The citrus season in the Northern Hemisphere is only November through June, and yet you can get fresh, not from concentrate, never frozen orange juice all year round. The way you do that, actually, if you're a big juice company, you pasteurize the orange juice, you strip out all the flavorings, the oils, the oxygen, you chill it down to 32 degrees centigrade, and you then keep it in a million-gallon refrigerated tank.
At a tank farm.
Exactly. You have, 25, 30 of these tanks all sat together in a tank farm. Is what they call it. I call it our National Industrial Breakfast Reserve. It's sitting there waiting to serve us fresh orange juice at any time of the year. You just have to take it out of the tank, mix in the flavorings that you stripped out, and put it in a carton, and there you go. Fresh, never frozen.
Mm. And you learned this from Alyssa Hamilton's book, Squeezed, What You Don't Know About Orange Juice. This orange juice that's been stripped down and on these tank farms can sit there for a year before being, as you say, rejuvenated. It can be shipped to a distribution center on refrigerated boxcars. I mean, this whole network, this whole coldscape makes orange juice possible. Some people can remember when orange juice was in a can and it had sort of this canned taste to it. That was what ready-to-drink orange juice was before this innovation.
Tank farms were introduced in the 1980s, and it was researchers at Purdue University who were working on how to store crushed tomatoes, actually, that came up with the idea of this kind of bulk tank, refrigerated tank storage. The orange juice industry knew that customers wanted something that had not been frozen and wasn't from concentrate. They knew there was that demand for the premium fresh orange juice, whatever fresh means in this context. So they invested in these tank farms and started out small, only quarter of a million gallon. Now they've got it perfected. They're vast. If you drive around in Florida, you can see them even from the highway, and they just are massive farms of tanks.
Well, and if you don't want orange juice, you know, reconstituted from a tank, fresh, never frozen, but maybe a year old, I don't know how you hold on to your vitamin C at that point. If you want to buy orange juice that isn't made that way, what would it say?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question because, unless you have it sort of squeezed in front of you, typically if it's not pasteurized, it has to be fresh. So there's that's one way to know that it hasn't been stored in a tank farm.
What else would you like us to know about refrigeration and our lives?
I think I'd really just like people to be curious and aware of the vast amount of space and energy that we put into creating this kind of artificial winter for our food, for our fruits and our vegetables and our meat and our butter and eggs. And not just, in and of itself, that's something to marvel at. You know, we as a civilization maintain this enormous amount of cold. But apart from that, it's just interesting to think of all the ways that it has transformed our lives, what we eat, how we use the land, our relationship with the environment, and what might happen if, as it seems is going to be the case, it becomes prohibitively expensive to keep so much space cool.
Nicola Twilley, author of the blog Edible Geography, co-founder of the Food Print Project, director of Studio XNYC, an urban futures network run by Columbia University's Grad School of Architecture, Preservation, and Planning, who wrote about the network of refrigeration spaces across the country, which she calls the country's coldscape, for Cabinet magazine. Nicola, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And so I've been handed a fact. According to health websites, pasteurized orange juice, which we talked about, had about a third less vitamin C than freshly squeezed. But the amount in a single cup of pasteurized still exceeds the daily recommended amount for adults. So there. Still ahead, more on Hillary Clinton's riveting testimony today. But the latest news is next, here and now.